Okay, here's how Miro works. See, it's amazing.
What's everyone doing at David's desk?
Ever since marketing started using Miro's collaborative online whiteboard, he thinks all our other teams should sign up.
Why?
He says Miro's making his meetings disappear. And if every team gets on it, that means even less meetings. They're using Miro for brainstorms, mind maps, customer research.
So could we use Miro instead of having another 100 meetings for every round of feedback?
Yep. You can comment, react to ideas, even leave a recording on the board.
And what about presentations?
There are Miro templates for that.
How do you know so much about Miro?
I've actually been using it all along. I just used a Miro board to plan the best vacation.
Okay, I'm on board.
See how Miro users save up to 80 hours every year by meeting less and doing more. Get on board at Miro.com with 3 boards free forever. That's Miro.com.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Boys in the Band podcast. But before we get into this one, we've got a quick message from our sponsors. Now, we know that out there, we've got lots of musicians, we've got lots of producers, fellow podcasters even listening into these episodes. And I'm sure there's plenty of you out there who deal with audio files on a regular basis as well. And if you do, you'll know that it's easy to get lost amongst all of the various demos and versions of a file.
Yeah, indeed. And we've been in touch with a new tech startup called Aux, who are looking for beta testers for their software. Anyone who signs up gets 10 gigabytes of free storage and the ability to easily share their files with collaborators and discover like-minded creators.
Yep, so if you've been frustrated by the clunkiness of storing and sharing music, then head to aux.app/boysintheband. That's aux.app/boysintheband, all one word. Sign up today to become a beta tester for their software and get that 10 gigabyte of free storage.
Yep, get on that. And thanks very much to Aux for supporting the Boys in the Band podcast. Speaking of which, let's get on with this week's episode.
Hello and welcome to the Boys in the Band podcast. I'm Peter Smith, and as ever, Rich Gallagher is with me. And this week, we were joined by Steve and Mark from Codaline.
It was great to chat to the Codaline boys for this podcast. They've got a brand new album coming out in October, a live album actually, with a bit of a twist to it though. But it sounds really, really, really interesting. And there's a tour on the way too. So they were really excited about that. And they were also really excited to chat about the noughties to us, the bands they loved back then and their inspirations too. But before we get to their choices, we should just flag that we've been sitting on this podcast with Codaline for a little while we were off on our holidays and various other things. But we were about to publish it last week when we decided we had to put a further pause on it. Because since we recorded with Steve and Mark, there have been some very serious allegations about Arcade Fire frontman Win Butler, which he does deny, we should point out. But in the podcast, we do talk about the Arcade Fire debut album and the band and Win. So we thought it would be remiss to put the podcast out at the time without making it very clear that when Steve does name that album as one of his favourite albums, praising Win Butler, he was, of course, speaking long before these claims came to light.
Yeah, important to flag that. And it's certainly a story which doesn't look like going away anytime soon for Win Butler and Arcade Fire. But yeah, just wanted to highlight this pod you're about to hear was recorded before we knew about these allegations. After the chat, me and Rich are going to talk a little bit more about this situation as well, in terms of what happens when there's misdemeanors within bands and allegations or crimes committed by band members, and how that makes us feel about bands and their music. So stick on for that afterwards. But yeah, a little bit of a shame that this story has come out at this time, because it overshadows what was otherwise a very enjoyable chat with the Codaline boys. We hear all about their new live album, as Rich mentioned, their upcoming tour, and yeah, some great reminiscing of the 2000s.
This week on the Boys in the Band podcast, we've got a special edition of My Naughty's number one album with Steve Garrigan and Mark Prendergast from Codaline. Thanks for coming on, guys. How's it going?
Really good.
Good. Thanks for having us on.
Yeah, good. Thanks, guys. Whereabouts are you based, Mark and Steve? Where are you at the moment?
We are in Ireland at the moment, just in our houses. We have a bit of downtime. So, yeah, just chilling, really.
Is that Dublin?
Yes, sorry, Dublin. We're kind of both. We grew up in a town called Swords, which is kind of close to Dublin Airport, and we've both kind of moved out about 5 minutes from the town we grew up in, so we're kind of out in the countryside a little bit.
Good. Back at base. Yeah. Well, great to have you on, as Rich says, and yeah, we're big fans of the band. I had the band that played at my wedding, Learn the One, just specifically for the first song that they played, and that earned me some brownie points. So I've got to say thank you to you guys for that. I'm sure it gets played at quite a lot of weddings. Sure, you must hear that quite a lot, don't you?
Yeah, well, the song was written as a wedding present originally. So it's kind of really humbling to hear that people have used it as their wedding song. So that's really cool, man. That's awesome.
Beautiful song. Yeah. Beautiful. Thank you. And I saw it's included on the new album that's coming out October 14th, Our Roots Run Deep. So it's a live album, but it's got a bit of a twist, right?
Yeah, well, it's something that we've wanted to do for a very, very long time. It's an acoustic album, and we're going to tour it as well at the end of the year around Europe. And there's a couple of shows in the UK as well. We have a good friend of ours playing cello on it, and yeah, it's acoustic, and it's the first time we've ever done that. A lot of the songs that we have and songs that we've written, Codeline songs, are usually written stripped down on a piano or with an acoustic guitar, and with the four of us in the band singing harmonies. So this live album kind of lends itself to that. And we recorded it, a whole show of some of our favorite Codeline songs, our own songs, over the last four albums. And we recorded it in the Olympia in Dublin, which is one of our favorite venues in the world, and kind of tried to capture the vibe on that night. And for us, the album is very special. It's a live album, live acoustic, and we hope that people feel as good about it as we do when they listen to it. So yeah.
Yeah, sounds very cool. And so there's a few covers on there as well. Billie Jean, Dirty Old Town. How did you come by choosing those ones?
Far ahead, Mark.
So we did a Sam Cooke song as well, Bring It On Home. They're kind of songs that we just, like, whenever we were asked to go into like a radio session, I think they're both for radio too, and we were asked to do a cover, they were the songs that we picked, and we just kind of like, it just felt like a shame to kind of just play them once in a radio show and then not play them again. So when we started touring, like our first album, we used to do an acoustic, like a fully acoustic version of Bring It On Home, where, you know, if there was like a balcony or something, we'd climb up to the balcony and sing without the PA. It was very challenging sometimes to try and get quiet, but there was something really kind of nice about the whole room just kind of going dead, and you just like, you're getting people to click their fingers and just the sound of the voices traveling. So it kind of made sense for us to do that, because like, we've been singing that song, I'd say 10 years, and it's just such a good song stripped back. And then Billie Jean was like I said, it's just for like a radio show. And we just liked the version that we kind of played it live. And that's kind of why that's there. And Dirty Old Town is, you know, we were playing in Dublin City. So it kind of fit.
It's kind of an unofficial national anthem in Ireland. Yeah.
Anytime I've been out in Dublin, you hear that song at some stage in the night. Whether it's actually being played in the pub by a band or sung on the street by some drunk guy walking down the road.
You could literally walk into a pub anywhere in Dublin and probably just go, and then walk out, and the whole place would just erupt into the whole song and finish it off. It's very popular, yeah.
Good. So we're going to be getting some sing-alongs and moments on the tour in September. October and November this year?
Yeah, hopefully so. Another idea with this album was to try and capture the audience singing along to all the songs throughout the show. And a lot of our shows that we do play, I try to encourage that as much as possible. Like if the crowd is singing along, you know, go with it and get them to sing louder and as loud as they can. And it really makes for a good show. So hopefully continues, and yeah, I hope people sing along because it's always good when they do.
So we know your first EP is Codeline, is Winding Back, came out in 2012, but read about how you've been playing as 21 Demands before that in the noughties, which is obviously the decade that we focus on in this podcast. And we've asked you both to pick out your favorite album from that era, but before that, what are your sort of memories of being in a band in that noughties era and sort of the inspirations you took ahead of taking it into your first releases in 2012 and then the debut album in 2013?
I think in those 2000s, there was just like just indie rock just became like the biggest thing. Like I remember going to a festival called Oxygen Festival in Ireland, and it was basically the sister festival to Tea in the Park. And I looked at a lineup of it recently, and it's just indie guitar band everywhere. And like all the bands that like I still like love now, like Arcade Fire and The Killers, all these bands are all like touring their first album around the same kind of couple of years, and they're all playing on the same kind of day sometimes. And like you listen to these albums like for a couple of years, and then you go to see them all play at the one time in the one place. Like it's nuts. But like the amount of great music that came out then, you know, it was it still sounds great now. And a lot of those bands have stood the test of time, you know, and they're still kind of doing what they were doing back then. And like some of the debut albums, even like if you look at like Arcade Fire's first album, it was so hard to pick one album, by the way. It took me ages, like Strokes. It was just like, it was great. Such a good time for music.
At that particular festival, Oxygen in Ireland, I think it was 2007. I was at that as well. And I have never seen a lineup as good since. It was Arcade Fire, Muse, Daft Punk, The Killers. Oh, yeah. Who else? There was everybody. It was
like Vampire Weekend touring the Vampire first
Weekend,
album.
Weekend, yeah.
There were so many of those bands, and they'd be playing in like a tent to like 10,000 people just playing their first album. And then, like Steve said, you go and see the headliners like Daft Punk, who I didn't go see. Still.
I wasn't into Daft Punk at the time, but a friend of mine convinced me to leave The Killers, who were like the biggest band in the world at the time. And by the way, their first album, Hot Fuss, is like one of the greatest albums ever made. And even choosing an album, as Mark said, from this era is so, 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 so difficult. But I didn't want to go to Daft Punk. And he was like, no, come on, check these guys out. And I was like, all right, yeah, I don't want to go. But The Killers are amazing. But I went, and still to this day, it was one of the most mind-blowing shows I've ever seen. It was when they had that pyramid and you see the two iconic Daft Punk robot heads just bobbing along to this huge light show and just commanding however many thousands and thousands of people to just dance. It was it was amazing. I'll never forget it, but yeah.
And such an inspirational time, I guess, then if you're in a band starting out, young guys, you know, wanting to make your way in the music industry, to see so many bands like that on that scene at that time.
Yeah, it was incredible. Like, yeah, I mean, I think when we first started, we were like heavily influenced by like Arctic Monkeys and who else, Mark? Like a lot of guitar bands.
We used to cover, what was the song we used to play, Arctic Monkeys song? Something When the Sun Goes Down?
Mm-hmm. Like When the Sun Goes Down.
We used to cover that.
Yeah, like
that
we used to play in pubs and stuff. And
it was kind of The Killers, like Arcade Fire, Arctic Monkeys were like the one, and The Strokes even before that. There was just so many, like, and just album after album just hitting you. It's like, wow. And I think at the time we were kind of, we hadn't fully carved out what the Code Line sound kind of is. And that's why, you know, we were a band in 2007 when there was all these bands, and there were certain songs we had that were very kind of guitar, like indie rock, but it wasn't what we were. And that's why it took us like 5 years from then to kind of become Codeline. But at that time, it was what we lived and breathed and what we listened to like all the time.
We were also teenagers as well in school. So the first band, 21 Demands, I suppose, is what we were called. We were kind of just finding our feet, and it took a while, but we fell in love with all that guitar music.
We also covered Radiohead, what do you call them? In the Morning.
In the Morning, Carl. Carl.
That's Jesus.
That's another album.
Razorlight, yeah.
The Carl. Totally forgot about them. Oh, man. What a band.
What a time, huh?
Yeah, you know that song? We'll set sail again. She's heading for the Spanish Main. And the harmony thing, like on... But then obviously they have one of the best pop songs ever written with do. Yeah.
Dreaming of You. Brilliant. Yeah.
So many bands. Yeah. Anyway.
So we can tell how much you've agonized, guys, over choosing your My Naughty's number one album. So Steve, how have you narrowed it down? What have you gone for?
I found it really, really tough because I'm a huge Coldplay fan, and Codeline music has, like, even when I've written songs, I'm always like, I always listen to Coldplay, and it kind of seeps into some of the songs that we have in a way. Like I'm just a huge Coldplay fan. So I was going to say Viva La Vida or A Rush of Blood to the Head. But then I also thought of Arcade Fire's Funeral, which that album I think is unbelievable as well. Like Wake Up and Lies, particularly Rebellion Lies, those two songs. I remember hearing Rebellion Lies for the first time and they were playing on Jules Holland. And I think it was like 2005 or something, but I very rarely got that feeling, like, and it's the best feeling ever, hearing a band or seeing a band for the first time and just being absolutely blown away and not knowing what that sound is, but just absolutely loving it. And that happened to me when I first heard Arcade Fire playing Rebellion Lies on Jules Holland. And then I got obsessed with the album and I've been a fan of theirs ever since.
What do you think made them stand out, Stephen, as different? Because they do have sort of their own distinctive sound, don't they?
Yeah, I think there's so many of them. And like, particularly with Wake Up, it's like, yeah, they're just, and that chorus on that song, you know, they're just screaming. And it's like, I don't know, maybe strength in numbers. I just, you know, it was a very unique sound as well. I read that they were a college band and, like, you know, such a cool story, like they just kind of got together in the music room and just started jamming, and then, you know,
Arcade Fire
then they became Arcade Fire, you know. Yeah, if only it was that simple. Yeah, I it was very unique at the time as well. I love Win Butler, isn't it?
Yeah,
I love his voice as well, and I remember the lyric as well. I love in Rebellion Lies in particular, like I just loved it. I hadn't really heard anything like it before. And it was powerful for me. I just thought it was really powerful and anthemic, you know?
Yeah, there's a huge drive to it. You're right. And anthemic is a really good word for it. And I mean, with their numbers, they were just able to layer like so many sounds. And it just, like you say, it sounded so powerful. It was just pounding a lot of those songs, really. You can just sort of feel it as you're listening to it. So they were a really unique band at the time, weren't they?
They had that guy as well, and they still have him. He just kind of hits a drum and but he's so into it and there's so much passion, you know. I don't know, I just found it infectious, you know. And the songs were great as well, so I loved it, I still do. So
just before we grab Mark's calls, you mentioned a couple of Coldplay albums there. It's funny when you think about Coldplay, I don't necessarily think of them as part of that era just because they were so massive and so big. It's almost like they just transcended the guitar scene, I guess, that we normally talk about. And I guess Rush of Blood to the Head was sort of the launch pad for that after Parachutes. And yeah, that was sort of a signal, I guess, that album, that they were going to go big time, big arenas, big, well, just be everywhere, basically, wasn't it? Because Parachutes felt, you mentioned about writing on an acoustic guitar and piano, and that's what Parachutes feels like to me, whereas Rush of Blood to the Head just feels so much bigger as an album. And then by the time you get to Viva La Vida, it's stadium stuff.
Yeah. They just kind of grew and their sound just kept getting bigger and bigger. And I mean, again, the songs as well for me, like Clocks, like, is unbelievable. Is Amsterdam on that album?
Yeah,
it's the last track. That's another like hidden gem. Like I was obsessed with that song. I mean, what was it produced by Brian Eno, or do you know that?
I think that was the Viva La Vida.
Viva La Vida was Brian Eno. Yeah, which makes sense. I mean, like for me, like A Rush of Blood to the Head. Like I always listen to. Another reason why I find it hard to pick an album is there's very few albums that, as a music listener, personally me, I never really listen to full albums. I'll hone in on songs and then I'll just listen to them over and over again. And I still kind of do that to this day, which is a bit annoying for like my girlfriend and friends because they're like, would you ever change the song? Yeah, like there's certain songs, like on Rush of Blood to the Head, Clocks and Amsterdam, and on Arcade Fire, Wake Up and Rebellion Lies jumped out to me. So, yeah. Anyway.
Yeah, I can definitely I can draw comparisons as well with your sound as well, I think, with Coldplay and Arcade Fire in terms of that sort of anthemic, obviously piano-based sort of lends itself as well. And yeah, that sort of driving indie rock, but in a sort of different sense to sort of the noughties indie scene of all those guitar bands we were talking about before. But yeah, I can definitely see where the inspiration could have come your way from there. But Mark, you've gone for something a little bit different to those.
Yeah, I went for LCD Sound System, Sound of Silver. It was so hard to pick. And I like all the bands we just mentioned there that I just forgot about. But yeah, Sound of Silver, it's kind of bittersweet because a friend of mine, just before we released our first EP, a friend of me, Anstey's, he passed away. But like one of the last things he shared with me was like, he was like, you need to listen to this album. And he like, it's kind of a part of it is that it's kind of like a parting gift from a friend. But the other thing is just, it took me a few listens to kind of fall in love with it, because initially I was drawn to the sound, like the electric guitars with like a real drums and then like analog synths and drum machines and like songs going on for like 8 minutes with like sometimes nothing happens for like a few minutes and then the vocal comes in. But then I started to like read the lyrics and the emotion in those songs is insane. Like we actually did a cover of
All My Friends.
We actually played it at his funeral, but we did a cover of that and we released it. And when we kind of did it how we would have done it had we written it. Like it was just piano, acoustic, and like a chorus of vocals. And taking the song from what it is to doing what we did, is that the song is just unbelievable any way you kind of play it or whatever. But yeah, it's that album that I think is the one that I listened to the most from that time. It was either that or The Strokes' Is This It, which is kind of an obvious one from that period because it kind of would have influenced a lot of what came after it. But yeah, it was LCD just because just that album, even the song like When Someone Great Is Gone, or I think it's just called Someone Great. But it's just so sad. And like the first few times you listen to it, on that album, I didn't listen to the lyrics because the music was so new to me. So that's my top pick.
Yeah, it's a great album. I remember at the time, I hadn't listened to LCD either, but Mark was obsessing over, I think at the same time, it's irrelevant, but your Talking Heads was another one.
Yeah.
But it's from a different era. But yeah, I mean, they're an incredible band. Like, and All My Friends is an unbelievable song. And it's, you know, we ended our friend who passed away, we dedicated our first album to him, and the song All My Friends, like, weren't you recording with him, Mark? And the version that we did for him was a gift to him, and we got all our friends to sing on it as well, and it's quite emotional. So that, yeah, song will forever be for us, be related to our friend. But
His name is Woodsy, and me and him, we used to like write, like he had a mad sense of humor, and we used to write these kind of joke songs. And there was one of the songs we did where he counted in 1, 2, 3, 4. So we took that and put it at the start of our recording. And like, sometimes I can't go back and listen to it because I just hear his voice, and it's kind of mad. But yeah, the other thing that made me love the album even more was that like they broke up and they did that big kind of
Madison Square Garden.
Yeah, and it was like, and I watched that over and over again, and then like, so in my head it was like, you know, it was like the Beatles. Like I'm never going to see the Beatles live. It was obviously a different level, but I was like, I'm never going to see them live ever. And then they came back, and I went to see them, and it just cemented the whole thing for me. It was like a full circle moment of like, I almost can't believe I'm seeing this band. And now they just tour all the time, so it's great. Like I've seen them maybe 5 or 6 times now. It's a good idea, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because they announced a farewell tour, and then when they came back, it was like, they were always a big band, but when they came back, they were headlining like festivals everywhere. So very.
You know the famous story of the Eagles? They said they'd never get back together until Hell Freezes Over, and then they released an album called Hell Freezes Over.
Genius. And toured it.
Yeah.
So when we see the Codaline farewell gigs announced for next year, we'll know what you're up to.
And a year later, we just announced a tour.
Just finally on that album, I was just sort of just reading about it. It's ranked number 5 by The Guardian on 100 best albums of the 21st century, which is quite an accolade.
And that was in 2019, so even quite recently as well. But it is sort of like, I find that if people are into LCD sound system, they're really into LCD sound system. Do you know what I mean? It's one of these things that when someone says, what's your favorite band? If they're into LCD sound system, it will be that band, and they'll talk to you all night about how good they are. They've just got that connection, haven't they, with their audience?
Very dedicated fans, yeah. It's kind of like a cult following. But they're amazing. Like,
good. Some good choices there, guys. Thanks very much.
What are your choices?
Oh, wow.
See, you're not getting away with it.
No, see, this has been turned on us before, and we struggle big time. And
come on, lads. Yeah, come on.
Like yourselves, we to and fro between different bands. But you know, the Arctic Monkeys were a big band for me and Pete, sort of when we first met at uni. And but the likes of the Maccabees and Jamie T were other like really important bands to us, artists to us at that point. It would be one of those for me, I think.
Yeah, I think it's hard to sort of pick, like as you guys have discussed, it's hard to pick an album like just because there was so much good music then or so many bands you connected with then. But I think for me, like the Libertines debut was probably just hit me at the right age and the right time. And, you know, seeing them and getting caught up in their whole story. And it was everything around it, you know. I think the whole, you know, the community around it as well online and, just so more than just those 10, 12 songs, whatever it was. It was that whole package around that debut album was pretty special for me, I think. Yeah.
So raw sounding. It was almost like so all over the place. Like it wasn't like as slick and tight as like most of the indie bands, but that's what the character was. It was just
exactly,
so jangly and like
it's brilliant, yeah.
Yeah.
All part of the charm.
We played a show in Benicassim Festival in Spain and got to watch them live there a couple of years ago. It was pretty amazing, to be honest.
Chaos.
It's
chaotic.
Good chaos.
They're another one, a little bit like LCD Sound System, where for a long, long time, I thought, I'm never going to get to see this band. I didn't see them first time round. And, you know, they had the big falling out and all that sort of thing. And then past five, 6 years or so, they've tour virtually every year, but still every time I go back I see them, they are incredible. And yeah, still a bit more organized, but
it's hard to choose from.
It's incredible. Yeah, it's incredibly hard to choose. I mean,
so what's the thing like now, guys, you know, as a band, you know, still going strong out on the road at the moment? What's it like as a band at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty cool. Like COVID was very strange because as a band, we've been touring since we started, like 2012, and we kind of been touring nonstop. And then all of a sudden the whole world was closed. So that was kind of strange, but we've played a good few shows since, and we have tours coming up, and it's cool. It's kind of, it's strange. Like we did this huge hometown gig to like 20,000 people or something like that. And when I walked on stage, I kind of like forgot that people liked us, you know, like, oh my God, what the hell? I had to kind of remember how to play and sing again. I don't know. It was very strange just after the kind of 2 years, you know, but it's great. Like I just feel very, very lucky to be able to, you know, be a musician and write songs and play in a band. So, it's really cool.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Sorry. There's no way to not make it sound like it's a good show. It just is.
Oh, yeah. Well, really looking forward to the album, guys. And best of luck with that and obviously the upcoming tour as well. Thanks very much for joining us today and making those very tough choices. Been a pleasure talking to you.
You too, lads. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks, guys. Really appreciate it. Cheers.
We made USAA insurance for veterans like James. When he found out how much USAA was helping members save, he said,
"It's time to switch.
We'll help you find the right coverage at the right price. USAA. What you're made of, we're made for. Restrictions apply."
So there you have it. Mark chose LCD Sound System, Sound of Silver, and Steve went for Arcade Fire Funeral, with a few honourable mentions in there as well. Two excellent albums of the noughties. But as we mentioned beforehand, a bit of a difficult situation when we get faced with these sorts of allegations in the press about certain artists and musicians when they may have had some transgressions and how that maybe affects us as music fans and our feelings towards them. It's quite a tricky thing to delve into and to sort of make those sorts of moral judgments yourself, how you feel about that that artist anymore, whether it changes the connection you have with that music. And yeah, I think it's really tricky. I think, you know, you can absolutely laud these musicians for great, masterful works of art that you absolutely love. But then if you hear that they've not quite the person you thought they were, or they've done some you know, unimaginable atrocities, you think, does that make the music less enjoyable? Does it take away from what they've done and sort of what they've produced in terms of their music? How does it make you feel? I think you have a connection to music, don't you? Whether that connection is altered once you learn a bit more about their private lives. And yeah, I mean, also I should also stress that, you know, this chat sort of comes from on the back of the Wim Butler allegation that he does deny, but also I think it is a difficult decision and morally for music fans to make. It's obviously nothing compares to the feelings of the actual victims of the crimes themselves. You know, we should put our sympathies to them first and foremost. That they've been victims here, and our enjoyment of their music sort of or not pales in significance compared to what they've been through. I think I also sort of feel sympathies as well towards people who've been victims of similar crimes with other people. Do you know what I mean? I think I often imagine how somebody might feel who was, you know, victim of sexual assault in one instance, and to then see somebody in the public eye who's maybe been accused of similar, how that would make you feel when you hear that artist's music, whether you're that person's victim or not. You know, it must be, you know, incredibly painful to have fallen victim to these people, and then to have them, you know, there, you know, as you go into the shops, you put on the radio, whatever, you hear their music. Unimaginable how that might make them feel.
Yeah, really good points, Rich. And I think you're right to say there that, yeah, the real victims are not the people agonising over whether they're allowed to like this music anymore. It's the people at the centre of these crimes or who have been affected by similar crimes elsewhere and around the world. But in terms of that connection that you speak about with the band and the music, I think that's quite an important element to this situation as well, because, you know, there's songs that I know and enjoy, but, you know, I wouldn't be able to pick the artist out of a lineup. You know, I probably wouldn't be able to tell you their names in some circumstances. But then there's other songs I'm connected with because of my admiration for that artist or that band. And undoubtedly, I think in that situation, my feelings towards that song would change if the veil or mystique was lifted on them. But then in that previous example, for an artist that I'm not really so familiar with, does that have such an impact on a song that I like? Yeah, very tricky, that one.
Yeah, it's tricky. And you know, I think as well, you think about these sort of situations where they come to light, you know, so many years down the line as well. In certain cases, we've been, you know, lauding these artists all the while them being these potential predators. And in the nicest way possible, sort of ignorance was bliss for us at that point. It was easy to not know about those transgressions and to still enjoy their music. But yeah, I think morally, it's such a tough one for the music fans to carry on listening to these artists. I know there's, you know, we're in a bit of an age of cancel culture and whatnot, and there were certain campaigns against, you know, particular artists and trying to get them muted on streaming sites. And you know, I think morally, it does feel wrong to listen to certain artists when you know what they've done.
Yeah, but Rich, in terms of listening to those artists, you say listen, or quite obviously Wim Butler, lead singer, frontman of Arcade Fire. Is it, does it have the same impact if it was a bass player of a band or someone? Because I think when you hear that frontman singing the lyrics, they represent the band, they represent that music. Would you have such a strong moral stance if it was just one of the other musicians in the band? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's a really good point. And not too sure. Perhaps you wouldn't. I suppose, yeah, when you've got that connection to the band themselves, I suppose the front man just has such a strong position, especially if they're the songwriter as well, where it's coming from. It's Yeah, maybe it would be different. And I suppose at the same time as well, you know, when we're talking about finding it difficult to listen to these bands and certainly not wanting to go and follow them on tour in the aftermath and that sort of thing, you know, that there are, you know, the victims themselves are obviously innocent in this, but also the other band members are potentially very innocent in all this as well. And it's one of those things that if the front man is done these things, it's harsh on the other band to sort of lose their livelihood for their transgressions, isn't it?
Yeah, especially if they start getting, as you say, cancelled off Spotify or Apple, yeah. Or venues start refusing to show them. For those band members, this is their livelihood and royalties, income. That all starts to get affected by what a colleague's done. I don't say you have to go against how you feel morally about listening to a band or buying their work or whatever, just to feel like you've got to support these members. But it's just worth bearing in mind that repercussions from these instances are very wide ranging, aren't they?
Yeah, you're right. It's not just the perpetrator that's necessarily going to be punished by it, is it, in those situations? But it's such a minefield, the whole moral standpoint that somebody takes. I mean, what do you think about it?
I think it would be, it's tough when you actually got to make your feelings clear on it or position clear on it, because I think so much of this is pretty fluid, you know, in terms of, we said about the connection you've got to band or certain songs or instances where you might feel more strongly about it than others, really. I can, for instance, you know, would I feel comfortable paying big money to go to a gig, standing down the front, looking up at a singer when they've been found guilty of serious crimes and, you know, that crime's well documented, well, you know, public knowledge, that would feel pretty uncomfortable, I think, to me, a bit odd to sort of be, you know, celebrating them in that way, in that live environment. But then would I feel comfortable listening to music that I like, knowing someone in the band, perhaps even the singer, has committed a serious crime? That feels like a little bit different because you're a bit more removed. You're in your own space. And so you might have connections with that song from years ago, or from that song might put you, you know, mentally into different memories and things like that, which are not strongly connected with that singer or that band member that's committed a crime in that band. Yeah, it's really tricky, but yeah, hard to pinpoint. I don't think there's any one clear answer on this, really. I think that's what we're getting to.
Yeah, definitely. As I say, it's not black and white. And I think you're right. It does depend a lot on your connection to that artist. Yeah, I think there were plenty of people out there who sort of may just sort of look upon it as a case of, well, you know, what they've done doesn't affect me. Why should I stop enjoying their music? I feel morally that's maybe not quite where I stand, but I would certainly know of people who have that opinion, and you sort of can understand where they're coming from in certain instances, things that happen all over the world that we don't know about, or that we do know about but doesn't necessarily affect us and we don't do anything about it in certain cases. So, you know, you can understand people taking that view, but yeah, I think we've said it a few times now, that connection you have to the music, to the art, I think is really, really important. And whether what that person may have done clouds your feeling about that art, you know, you think of it in artistic terms. You know, if you look at this beautiful painting or sculpture or whatever, you know, if you then find out that the artist has committed these sorts of crimes, will it make that painting or sculpture less beautiful? It depends on your connection to it and how you how that their crimes would necessarily cloud your connection to it.
Also, Rich, I think your feelings about certain crimes, you know,
yeah,
what we're talking about here is sexual assault, but there's a lot of crime in the rock and roll industry which is glamorized, isn't it? If you're thinking about drug taking or smashing up hotel rooms or whatever it is, fighting, you know, there's obviously different levels of crime in terms of what I've just mentioned there and where they'd be ranking in terms of like judicially, but also how you feel about certain crimes. Some crimes you might just, you know, shrug off and think, well, you know, he's a rock star, he should be doing that sort of thing. But then you might have an instance like this where you think, no, that's a line for me, and I'm not happy with paying good money or listening to music produced by someone who does this.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think there's so many points I think we could go over in terms of sort of back and forth on why people might feel one way or the other about it. I know some people have argued to me about, you know, trusting the judicial decisions that are made, whether you think, oh, that person wasn't actually guilty, or that person got found not guilty, and, you know, no smoke without fire, they must have been, you know, dodgy or whatever. And yeah, so you're having your faith in that system. I think going on from that, whether if they do serve any sort of time, and, you know, we're in a society of a system of correction, when they do get served their time and things, do these artists deserve that second chance after they've served their time? If they show, you know, certain contrition, you know, do they deserve forgiveness and a second chance? Yeah, again, I think a lot will depend on the crimes they've committed and your connection to that crime as well. Like you say, if it's you know, somebody's done some time for, you know, burning their mate's flat for drug money or whatever, compared to you know, these sorts of sexual harassment cases, or sexual assault cases rather, it's slightly different. But yeah, and, you know, there are other cases, that there are so many cases in the news that, you know, we could refer to. And, you know, there's one that sort of springs to mind where, you know, this artist has been, you know, chucked out of the band that they've been a huge part of, but the victim of the alleged crime has sort of forgiven him, and, you know, they're getting on well together, going about their lives. So if the victim themselves can forgive the perpetrator here in this situation, should music fans follow suit?
Heavy stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, very heavy stuff. Yeah.
So I think we just set up a podcast to talk about going to gigs in our teens and early 20s. Yeah? But I guess it's just it's a reflection, isn't it, of how important music is to people, and how important musicians are to people. When you let them into your lives, you want to be able to trust them. And there you go.
Yeah. I think just before we finish off this, I think the word there is trust as well. I think in a lot of these situations, these artists are abusing the trust that they've got because of their position, and they're find themselves in these situations where they can be predators and things like that. And I definitely do feel, you know, we should close by focusing on those victims. They are where our sympathy lies wholeheartedly. And while we think it is an interesting debate and one worth having, our thoughts are firmly with the victim first and foremost. But yeah, cheers, Pete. Good to chat about the topic. And cheers to the Codaline Boys for coming on, and had a really good chat with them. We look forward to their new live album and tour coming up in the autumn. Thanks for listening to the Boys in the Band podcast. We'll speak to you soon.
Okay, here's how Miro works. See, it's amazing.
What's everyone doing at David's desk?
Ever since marketing started using Miro's collaborative online whiteboard, he thinks all our other teams should sign up.
Why?
He says Miro's making his meetings disappear. And if every team gets on it, that means even less meetings.
They're using Miro for brainstorms, mind maps, customer research.
So could we use Miro instead of having another 100 meetings for every round of feedback?
Yep. You can comment, react to ideas, even leave a recording on the board.
And what about presentations?
There are Miro templates for that.
How do you know so much about Miro?
I've actually been using it all along. I just used a Miro board to plan the best vacation.
Okay, I'm on board.
See how Miro users save up to 80 hours every year by meeting less and doing more. Get on board at Miro.com with 3 boards free forever. That's Miro.com.